The Popular Mechanics book makes an even more outlandish claim about alert fighters, alleging that after the end of the Cold War, the United States did not keep any armed fighters on alert. They support this claim with a statement by former Republican Senator Warren Rudman, who was quoted in a Boston Globe article as saying, "We don't have capable fighter aircraft loaded with missiles setting on runways in this country. We just don't do that anymore. To expect American fighter aircraft to intercept commercial airliners is totally unrealistic." This quotation comes at the conclusion of Popular Mechanics' section on interceptions, in which it argued that the military's failure to intercept the airlines does not mean that there had been a stand-down order. This quotation was evidently intended as the knockout punch. However, if one actually reads the Boston Globe article, one finds that it does not conclude with the quotation from Rudman. The writer instead follows it with this statement. Otis offers something close to that posture, however. Its 102nd Fighter Wing is equipped with two armed and fueled aircraft ready to fly around the clock each day of the year. So much for Popular Mechanics' knockout punch and its honesty. What was true at Otis, incidentally, was true of other alert bases around the country. For example, Captain Tom Pickle Herring, a pilot at Homestead Air Force Reserve Base near Miami, was quoted in 1999 as saying, "We have weapons on our jets. We need to be postured such that no one would dare threaten us. If needed, we could be killing things in 5 minutes or less." As this and many other examples show, the subtitle of the Popular Mechanics book needs to be expanded to read, "How Conspiracy Theories Cannot Stand Up to the Facts If We Are Allowed to Determine What the Facts Are." Another question that can be answered responsibly only on the basis of an empirical investigation of the facts is why 3 buildings of the World Trade Center collapsed after 2 of them were struck by airplanes. Early reports claimed that the fires had melted the steel. A BBC television special 2 days after 9/11 quoted 2 experts as saying this. But some early members of the 9/11 truth movement, getting empirical, pointed out that although steel does not begin to melt until it reaches about 1,500 degrees Celsius, 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, the maximum temperature that can be reached by diffuse fires based on hydrocarbons, such as jet fuel, would be about 1,000 degrees Celsius, 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Accordingly, even if the fires had been as hot as building fires could possibly get under the most ideal circumstances, they could not have come even close to melting any steel. In response to this debunking, Popular Mechanics has accused the 9/11 truth movement of creating a straw man argument, which could easily knock down. Popular Mechanics implies, in other words, that no defenders of the official theory had ever said that the buildings collapsed because their steel melted. The falsity of this claim is illustrated by the BBC special. It has also been illustrated more recently by Lee Hamilton, the vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, while he was being interviewed by Evan Solomon of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Hamilton, saying that the commission rejected the view that the buildings were brought down by explosives, said, "What caused the collapse of the buildings was that the superheated jet fuel melted the steel superstructure of these buildings." Hamilton's astounding statement suggests that the 9/11 Commission, while endorsing the government's theory that the towers collapsed because of the impact of the airplanes and the resulting fires, did not even discuss such elementary facts as the melting point of steel and the maximum temperature of diffuse hydrocarbon fires. The definitive report on the destruction of the towers was supposed to be produced by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. But its report, in spite of its thousands of pages, is far from definitive. Journalists have typically assumed that because the NIST report is based on the work of scientists, it is a scientific report. One of the main problems with this report, however, is that the conclusions are radically at variance with the work of its own scientists. Some scientists reading this said, I couldn't believe my eyes. This enormous discrepancy between the empirical facts reported and then the conclusions. For example, NIST suggests the steel columns in the core buckled because they were heated up to 1,000 degrees Celsius, over 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, at which point they would have lost 90% of their strength. NIST's own scientists, however, reported that none of the recovered steel had reached temperatures over 250 degrees Celsius, 480 degrees Fahrenheit. And these were columns from around the outside of the buildings where there was air. The 47 core columns would have not gotten even that hot because of a lack of oxygen in the center of the buildings. So although NIST claims that the towers collapsed because their core columns reached 1,000 degrees Celsius, studies by its own scientists show that the core columns would not have been even one-fourth that hot. As this example shows, the NIST report, on which Popular Mechanics and much of the press has relied, is not a scientific report. It is a political document put out by an agency of the Bush administration. Equally unempirical is the treatment by NIST and Popular Mechanics of reports of explosions before and during the collapses. Both documents pretend that there were no explosions, even though the latest time I checked Google for testimonies of explosions in the World Trade Center, I found that there were close to 300,000 items. One of those items is an essay I wrote called Explosive Testimony, which quotes 41 people, including firefighters, emergency medical workers, WCC employees, and journalists, reporting that they witnessed what seemed to be explosions. For example, Wall Street Journal reporter, you know that left-wing rag, don't you? Wall Street Journal reporter John Bussey said, "I looked up out of my office window to see what looked like perfectly synchronized explosions coming from each floor, one after another. From top to bottom, the floors blew to pieces." Another item on the internet is an essay by Canadian professor Graham McQueen, which shows that even if we restrict our focus to members of the New York Fire Department, we have 118 testimonies suggestive of explosions in the towers. NIST and Popular Mechanics, however, write as if these testimonies do not exist. Nothing better illustrates their wholly unempirical, unscientific approach. This unempirical approach is reflected, moreover, in journalistic accounts that rely on these official and semi-official reports. For example, Alexander Coburn, in assuring his readers that members of the 9/11 truth movement are nuts, said, "People inside who survived the collapse didn't hear a series of explosions." Coburn thereby revealed that he had not studied the evidence enough to be aware of one of the best-known testimonies by a person inside the towers, North Tower employee Teresa Veliz. She said that while she was making her way downstairs, "There were explosions going off everywhere. I was convinced that there were bombs planted all over the place, and someone was sitting at a control panel pushing detonator buttons. There was another explosion, and another. I didn't know where to run." As Coburn's embarrassing essay demonstrates, journalists cannot safely rely on reports written to support the official conspiracy theory. They need to get empirical about 9/11. NIST and Popular Mechanics, besides dealing with testimony about explosions in an unempirical manner, do the same with regard to reports that molten metal was found under the rubble beneath all three buildings. The scientists at NIST knew, unlike Lee Hamilton, that the fire could not have melted any steel. So their preferred method of dealing with these reports was simply to ignore or even deny them. John Gross, one of the authors of the NIST report, was captured on film saying in a public presentation that he knew of absolutely no eyewitness who has said that there was a pool of molten steel. Popular Mechanics cites a professor's claim that the photographs said to show molten steel really show materials that appear to be other than steel, such as glass with unmelted steel rods in it. Popular Mechanics then quotes triumphantly this professor's observation that glass melts at a much lower temperature than steel. However, the evidence for molten steel under the rubble was neither non-existent nor based merely on photographs. There were many eyewitnesses, including Peter Tully, president of a company involved in the cleanup, who said he saw pools of literally molten steel at the site. The same was reported by Marc Loiseau, whose company Control Demolition, Inc., was also involved in the cleanup, and by fire captain Philip Rivolo, who said, "You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel, running down the channel rails, like you're in a foundry, like lava." Although these and many other eyewitness testimonies exist, NIST writes as if they did not. Nevertheless, surely knowing that they do, NIST has suggested, in a document put out in 2006 entitled Answers to Frequently Asked Questions, that even if there was some molten steel in the rubble pile, it was more likely due to the high temperature resulting from long exposure to combustion within the pile than to explosions. Popular Mechanics expanded on this incredible explanation, saying, "The debris pile sat cooking for weeks, with the materials at the bottom of the pile getting increasingly hot because the fires were confined and lost minimal heat to the atmosphere. As a result, the fires could have easily reached temperatures sufficient to melt steel." This is amazing. Hydrocarbon fires, as you may remember from your high school physics class, they require oxygen. According to NIST and Popular Mechanics, however, the fact that the fires were not exposed to the atmosphere did not extinguish them. It allowed them to get hotter. Indeed, over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. This is what passes for science at NIST and Popular Mechanics these days. The unscientific approach taken by NIST here has been pointed out by physicist Stephen Jones, one of the leading scientists in the 9/11 truth movement. When NIST says that any melted steel was most likely caused by high temperatures produced by combustion in the debris pile, Jones points out, this is pure speculation, not science. For an explanation to count as scientific, it must be based on either historical precedent or experimental results. But NIST cites no experimental evidence and not a single historical precedent. It is, again, members of the 9/11 truth movement, not defenders of the official theory, who have been insisting on getting empirical about 9/11. What caused the damage at the Pentagon? According to the official conspiracy theory, the Pentagon was struck by American Airlines Flight 77 under the control of hijacker Hani Hanjour. The 9/11 truth movement has presented many arguments against this theory. Popular Mechanics claims to have refuted all of these arguments, but it has not even come close. I've already touched on one problem with the official story, which is there is no good evidence that Flight 77 was still airborne after it disappeared from FAA radar in the Midwest. This is one point that Robin Horton has stressed. The only evidence consisted of two phone calls that allegedly came from the plane. The alleged call from Barbara Olson, we have seen, does not stand up to scrutiny. The only other alleged call was from flight attendant Renee May, although Popular Mechanics calls her a passenger. Her alleged call, however, was supposedly made on a cell phone at 9:12 when the plane was at 24,000 feet, so it would have been impossible. So there is little, if any, reason to believe that Flight 77 returned to Washington. There is, moreover, an even stronger reason for rejecting the official theory. Hani Hanjour was known to be a terrible pilot, so terrible that he could not even fly a single-engine airplane well enough that a flight instructor would go up with him a second time. Standard newspaper reports quoted people as saying, I'm so shocked they said he had a license. He couldn't fly at all. And yet, in order to hit wedge one of the Pentagon, according to the official story, he had to perform an amazing feat in his hijacked airliner, bring it down 8,000 feet in a 330-degree downward spiral in under 4 minutes, then bring it in at ground level without even scraping the lawn to hit the Pentagon between the first and the second floors. Getting empirical about this claim means asking experienced airline pilots if this was possible. Russ Wittenberg, one of the many pilots who belonged to the 9/11 Truth Movement, says that he, in spite of his 35 years of experience flying commercial airliners, could not have done it. For an amateur who couldn't even fly a Cessna to maneuver the jetliner in such a highly professional manner, Wittenberg adds, would have been totally impossible. Ralph Omholt, a former 757 pilot, agrees, saying, "The idea that an unskilled pilot could have flown this trajectory is simply too ridiculous to consider." How did popular mechanics deal with this problem? It ignored it. Although its authors like to tell us how many experts they consulted, they did not report asking any airplane pilots if Honjour could have flown this trajectory. Indeed, they do not even mention this trajectory. They refer to this part of the alleged flight of American 77 only in passing. That is, after arguing that although Honjour was not a great pilot and had never flown an airliner before, he was able to get this plane back to Washington by putting it on autopilot. They add, "He steered the plane manually for only the final 8 minutes of the flight, for only the final 8 minutes when the impossible was done." Popular Mechanics claims that it has shown all the key claims of the 9/11 Truth Movement to be mistaken. One of the movement's central claims, however, is that whatever damaged the Pentagon, it could not have been Flight 77 under the control of Hani Honjour. Popular Mechanics does not even try to refute this claim, perhaps hoping that most of its readers will not notice. It also fails to deal with another claim on which there is unanimity within the 9/11 Truth Movement, that if Al-Qaeda terrorists had hijacked an airline in order to crash it into the Pentagon, they would not have chosen to hit Wedge 1. This claim is based on several empirical facts about this section of the Pentagon. For one thing, Wedge 1 was the only section that had been renovated to make it less vulnerable to terrorist attacks. Also, because the renovation was not yet complete, it was only sparsely populated. A strike on any other part of the Pentagon would have caused far more damage and far more death. Moreover, terrorists who hated America would presumably have wanted to kill Secretary Rumsfeld and the top brass at the Pentagon. But they were over on the opposite side of the building, as far from Wedge 1 as possible. All these facts, moreover, were well known. If these terrorists were brilliant enough to outfox the world's most sophisticated defense system, they would not have gone out of their way to hit Wedge 1 when they could have simply crashed into the roof above the offices of Rumsfeld and the senior officers. Again, however, Popular Mechanics is silent, not even acknowledging the problem. These points about Hani Honjour and Wedge 1, concerning which there is unanimity within the 9/11 Truth Movement, are sufficient to disprove the official conspiracy theory about the damage to the Pentagon. However, besides not refuting these points, Popular Mechanics does not even refute the empirical reasons pointed out by some members of the 9/11 Truth Movement for saying that the damage was not even caused by a Boeing 757. One problem with the 757 claim is that, according to the two seismologists who were asked to determine the exact time of the four crashes that morning, Wonyoung Kim of Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory and Gerald Baum of the Maryland Geological Survey, the seismic signals generated by whatever damaged the Pentagon were too weak to be detected. Kim and Baum did, by contrast, get clear seismic signals from the attacks on the Twin Towers and even the crash into the soft soil in Pennsylvania of Flight 93. For people who accept the official story, this should be very puzzling. If strong seismic signals were generated by airliners on those other three places, why was not even a detectable signal generated by an airliner crashing into the rigid, steel-reinforced side of Wedge 1 of the Pentagon? Here's what Popular Mechanics says about this problem. That was it. As usual, Popular Mechanics simply ignores the problem. Still another problem with the official story is the fact that a round hole, about 9 feet in diameter, was created in the Pentagon C ring, 310 feet from the impact zone, at the place a projectile continuing the attacking aircraft's alleged trajectory would have hit. The official explanation from the beginning was that this hole was made by Flight 77's nose. Lee Evey, the program manager for the Pentagon renovation project, said the plane actually penetrated through the E ring, D ring, C ring. The nose of the plane just barely broke through the inside of the C ring, so it was extending into AE drive a little bit. Don Rumsfeld said on Good Morning America, 2 days after 9/11, the plane went in through three rings. I'm told the nose is still there. However, the nose of a 757 is very fragile. It could not have gone through the outer wall with its steel-reinforced concrete, made its way through concrete columns inside the building, and then punched out a large hole in the C-ring wall. The popular mechanics authors, evidently realizing this, decided to come up with a new explanation. Without acknowledging that they are contradicting the official story told by Rumsfeld and others, these popular mechanics authors say, in fact, the hole was not made by the nose of a Flight 77 pushing through the building's interior. Instead, they say, the hole was created by the plane's landing gear, which, according to the official report on the Pentagon, was found nearby. But this theory has its own problems. In any case, the popular mechanics authors, far from defending the government's story about the Pentagon, have instead emphasized the absurdity of its explanation of the hole in the C-ring by offering a different explanation. They have thereby supported the view that Pentagon officials were lying. Popular mechanics has definitely not defended the idea that the Pentagon was struck by American Flight 77 under the control of Hani Hanjour. Another problem with the official conspiracy theory, and this will be the last of the problems, involves the crash of United Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. At first, the official story was that it crashed because the heroic passengers brought it down. The story was later revised to say that the plane crashed because the hijackers, fearing that they were going to be overpowered by the heroic hijackers, brought it down at 580 miles per hour. From the first, however, there was considerable evidence that the flight was actually shot down by the U.S. military. This evidence is of many types. Witnesses reported seeing debris falling from the plane. Debris was spread over an 8-mile area. One engine, or part of it, was found far from the crash site, suggesting that it was hit by a heat-seeking missile. There was no plane at the crash site, leaving officials with no option but to claim that the plane had buried itself completely underground, so even the tail didn't show. Several residents in the area reported seeing a small white jet plane prior to the crash and hearing sounds suggestive of a shootdown. One resident said that she received a call from a friend who reported shortly after the crash that her husband, who was in the Air Force, had called and said, "I can't talk, but we've just shot down a plane." One of the Otis pilots reported being told after he returned to base that an airliner had been shot down in Pennsylvania by a military F-16. And Paul Cellucci, Washington's envoy to Canada, told an audience in Toronto in 2005 that a Canadian general was in charge of NORAD on 9/11 when it shot down a hijacked aircraft headed for Washington. Popular mechanics deals with a few of the items in this list by distorting the evidence and with the remaining items by remaining silent about them. You can read all that in my book. Here I will focus only on the most important element in its attempted refutation of the claim that United 93 was shot down. This is the claim made by the 9/11 Commission that the military could not have shot down the flight because it was not even aware that this plane had been hijacked until after it had crashed. Here is Popular Mechanics' statement. As to whether a fighter could have shot down the plane, the 9/11 Commission report is clear that no shoot-down order was in place for Flight 93 due to garbled communication between the various agencies. When the flight crashed, NORAD was still unaware that the plane had crashed. It is true that the 9/11 Commission makes this claim. But is this claim supported by the available facts? The editors of Popular Mechanics, in their introduction, said that they were going to confront the claims of the 9/11 truth movement with the facts. What they do here, however, is simply confront the claim made by the 9/11 truth movement with the claim made by the 9/11 Commission that the military did not learn about the hijacking of Flight 93 until 10:07, several minutes after it reportedly crashed. In citing this claim as authoritative, Popular Mechanics simply ignores the empirical fact that many of the participants made statements that contradicted the Commission's claim. Here are some examples. General Larry Arnold, who was the commanding general of NORAD within the continental United States, when asked by the 9/11 Commission what NORAD was doing at 9:24, said, "Our focus was on United 93, which was being pointed out to us very aggressively by the FAA. 9:24 was 40 minutes earlier than the 9/11 Commission later claims the FAA told the military about Flight 93. Richard Clark, who in 2001 was the National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, was directing a video conference from the White House on 9/11. In his book, Against All Enemies, he says that at 9:35, Jane Garvey, the head of the FAA, reported that there were several airliners that were considered possibly hijacked at the time, one of which was United 93 over Pennsylvania. And as Clark reports, Rumsfeld and Myers were participating in that video conference. During an interview with Peter Jennings on ABC in 2002, Brigadier General Montague Winfield, who was the Deputy Director of Operations at the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, said, "We received the report from the FAA that Flight 93 had turned off its transponder and was now heading towards Washington, D.C. General Myers said that fighters were scrambled on the airliner that eventually crashed in Pennsylvania. 2 days after 9/11, Paul Wolfowitz, who was then Deputy Secretary of Defense, said that the Air Force was tracking the hijacked plane that crashed in Pennsylvania." And so on and so on and so on. Other quotes, but I'll move on. Saying we have extremely strong evidence, therefore, that insofar as the NORAD tapes given to the 9/11 Commission and Michael Bronner say otherwise, they have been doctored. And Robin Horton has given me lots of clues about how easy it would have been to doctor those tapes. They do not provide the authentic military history of 9/11 or anything close to it. In this lecture, I've given several examples of what you can learn about 9/11 if you get empirical, checking the actual facts rather than simply, like Popular Mechanics and far too many journalists, equating the facts with the claims made by people defending the official conspiracy theory. The prohibitions against getting empirical about 9/11 are, to be sure, very powerful. Bill Moyers, in his recent PBS show, Buying the War, pointed out through interviews with journalists that the prohibitions against getting empirical about the administration's claims about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction were very powerful. The prohibitions against getting empirical about 9/11 are even more powerful. But if reporters and news organizations will develop the courage to do this, examining the official conspiracy theory in light of already available evidence, the theory will completely unravel. Evidence for this claim is provided by former senior CIA analyst Bill Christensen, who said in a letter to friends in August of 2006, "I spent the first 4.5 years since September 11th utterly unwilling to consider seriously the conspiracy theories surrounding the attacks of that day. In the last half year, and after considerable agony, I've changed my mind." In an essay entitled "Stop Belittling the Theories About September 11th," he summarized what he considered persuasive evidence that the official story was false. This conclusion is of overwhelming importance, Christensen argues, because 9/11, the fraud of 9/11, involves a much greater crime against the American people and the people of the world than any other charges of fraud connecting with the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. Why? It is more important because the events of 9/11 have been used by the administration to justify every single aspect of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East since September 11th. It is also more important because it affects the very core of our entire political system. It is a conspiracy so far successful, not only against the people of the United States, but against the entire world. Christensen's analysis makes clear why getting the truth about 9/11 publicly revealed is so important, but it also explains why it will be so difficult. One reason was pointed out by former CIA case officer Robert Baer in an interview with Tom Hartman, during which Baer revealed that he, too, had changed his mind about 9/11, deciding that it was an inside job. A lot of people in the United States have profited from 9/11, said Baer. Great fortunes are being made. This is a problem for getting the truth about 9/11 revealed, because those who are making the great fortunes include corporations who control the mainstream media. Moreover, even if the corporate owners of the media would not forbid it, the major news organizations would be loath to admit now how, by ridiculing the 9/11 truth movement rather than reporting the facts it had uncovered, they had helped cover up the truth about 9/11, thereby aiding and abetting the policies of the Bush-Cheney administration. Nevertheless, I believe there is still hope that the truth may come out. Other countries, such as Canada and several European countries, may begin exposing the lies so loudly that the American press will not be able to pretend not to hear. The activist side of the 9/11 truth movement in the United States and other countries may begin organizing mass rallies to demand that the truth finally be told. The Democrats, now in control of Congress, may develop the courage to hold hearings about 9/11. If so, the press will have little choice but to report them. At some point, the press may realize that to save its own reputation, it will need to get out in front on this story so it can take credit for uncovering it. The 9/11 truth movement is now far stronger than it was only a year ago, thanks to the addition this past year of many more scientists, architects, engineers, pilots, and former members of the military and intelligence services. It is now much more obvious that the 9/11 movement is based on professional, informed evaluations of the empirical evidence, and that it is the official story that fits what most people mean when they say they reject conspiracy theories, theories that, being based on groundless speculation, are wildly at odds with the evidence, except for evidence that was planted. But perhaps the greatest boon to the 9/11 truth movement is the fact that in 2006, defenders of the official theory, rather than continuing simply to ridicule the 9/11 truth movement and call us names, decided to try to debunk these claims. These attempts backfired because they served only to make clear how completely at variance with the empirical evidence the official theory is. By demonstrating this, my latest book is evidently more convincing than my previous ones. In a statement on Amazon.com, international lawyer John Whitbeck says, "After reading David Ray Griffin's previous books on the subject, I was over 90% convinced that 9/11 was an inside job. Now, after reading Debunking 9/11 Debunking, I am, I regret to say, 100% convinced." I hope this book will help the worldwide 9/11 truth movement finally reveal the truth about 9/11. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
David Ray Griffin, speaking May 16th in Vancouver, B.C. We continue with questions from the audience.
Thank you very much, Dr. Griffin. That was a wonderful speech. Now, before we begin the questions, I would like to quickly give some details about the upcoming Vancouver 9/11 Truth Conference that will be held here in Vancouver through June 22nd through 24th. Now, the slogan of our conference is going to be 9/11, Canada, and the New World Order. Now, as this slogan suggests, we will not only be discussing 9/11, but we will have speakers talking about the changes in Canada since 9/11, about the New World Agenda, the usage of Canadian mine depleted uranium in the battlefield, and various other related topics, including, most importantly, solutions. Now, we will be having speakers coming in from all around the globe. We're going to have keynote speeches from former BYU professor and physicist Dr. Stephen Jones, as well as from historian and author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, Webster Griffin Tarplay. Now, also, we will have former Canadian diplomat and English professor from the University of California, Professor Peter Dale Scott. And as Dr. Griffin mentioned in his speech, we will also have Robin Horden and Roland Morgan with us as well, as well as the author of a novel about 9/11 called Modus Operandi, 9/11, a Mr. Hal Sisson. Now, these three gentlemen are all here today, and after the questioning, they will be in the back foyer at the table where we will be selling tickets for the conference to ask or to answer any questions that you may have about them. Now, some of our other speakers, we will have international lawyer and a judge in the War Crimes Tribunal in Malaysia and the international director for the Institute for Cooperation in Space, Dr. Alfred Weber. And we will also have a toxologist who participated in classified projects and simulations of bioterror attacks and bioweapons in the late 1990s, Dr. William Deagle. So tickets for this conference, which again will be through June 22nd through 24th, these can be purchased at our website, which is v911truth.org. That's v911truth.org. So we hope to see you all there. So we're going to begin the questions now. So the first question we have is, I have long wondered if anyone has seen or requested a copy of the passenger manifest from the plane that is alleged to have crashed into the Pentagon.
This is a very puzzling thing. In the first years after 9/11, we got passenger manifests released by the airlines and published, and they had no Arab names on them. None of the names of the alleged hijackers were on them. Now, sometime in this last year, a manifest appears from the flights, and suddenly all the names are on there. I just don't know what to make of that. That's about all I can say of it. I have my suspicions, but I don't have any facts.
All right, second question. What ultimately is 911 Truth hoping for? When Bush is long gone, what is the main objective?
First of all, very few people in the 9/11 movement believe that this was planned by George W. Bush. And not just for the reason you're thinking, but also because we have word from 1999 that an undercover agent picked up. Somebody said, looking at the towers, those towers are coming down. So this seems to be something that had been planned for some time. But the question still stands. What do we hope to gain? Certainly it would be very nice if the truth about 9/11 could be revealed in time for that to be the major reason the Bush-Cheney administration would leave office before their tenure is up. Many of us have worked very hard getting out our work as quickly as possible to try to bring about that effect. But these things work slowly, if at all. And so that may not happen. But I still think it will be very important that the truth be revealed, because the work that I was writing when I finally woke up about 9/11, about a year and a half afterwards, was a history of American imperialism. I'd been working on a previous book for about almost a decade on the need to have a democratic global structure of the planet as a whole, and had all sorts of reasons: the ecological crisis, the global apartheid, the economic division between the rich and the poor, and many, many other things, the nuclear problem, of course. And I didn't have a chapter on U.S. imperialism, even though that was the theme, underlying theme of every other chapter. So I thought, well, I need a chapter on this. So I started writing that and working away on it, and I had it about three-fourths finished when I finally woke up, and then I put that aside and say, oh, I'll do this. This will take a few months of my time, and then I'll get back to that work. This was, of course, 2003. One thing I learned by doing that, I knew it a little bit before, but it really ingrained it in me, is that U.S. imperialism has been a very long-standing project. We're talking about over a century. And it also has been an equal opportunity employer. Democrats as well as Republicans have promoted American imperialism. Maybe Democrats have done it a little smarter, a little subtler, in a little less obvious way. There's something nice about the Bush-Cheney administration. They're so obvious. Nothing subtle about them. And particularly switching from economic imperialism primarily to military imperialism makes it so much more obvious. So that's my hope, because I fear that if we just remove this administration without revealing what was going on, and that and the argument I've made in my previous books, the one with Peter Dale Scott, 9/11 and American Empire, and then my book, the only book on this that I've written, Quoth Christian Theologian, Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, I stress that Christians, above all, should be concerned to get the truth exposed, because Christianity began as an anti-imperial gospel. Jesus was preaching an anti-imperial gospel. If you don't know about this, read the book by Richard Horsley, Jesus and Empire. And 9/11 was carried out in the name of American imperialism. And therefore, it shows most graphically the values that lie behind empire, and American empire in particular. And these are very ugly values. These are values that are diametrically opposed to the purpose of the universe, if you have any kind of religious view of the universe. And therefore, I call it demonic, being diametrically opposed to the divine and powerful enough to defeat divine purposes. We're threatening to bring this very experiment of life on this planet to a grossly premature end. If we don't get serious about global warming, if we don't put an end to nuclear weapons. So that's my hope, that whether this has anything to do with getting rid of Bush and especially Dick Cheney, that the truth will come out pretty soon. And if the American people realize that 9/11 was carried out in the name of American empire, they will turn away from that. It will cause such revulsion. So that's my hope anyway.
Okay, and how would you recommend engaging with mainstream or conservative members of the public who are non-believers of the 9/11 truth movement?
I don't know. You might write a book. I mean, that's the only thing I know to do, is try to write. I mean, I write lots of books. I write lots of articles. I get lots of DVDs made. I hear that these days some people don't read a whole lot, so people do watch DVDs. But the serious part of the question is, how can other people who aren't in position to write books and give lectures, what can they do? Well, the obvious thing right now is to join the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Movement and get involved, and then yourself learn enough facts so that you can talk sensibly about these matters, so that you can counter the lies. The lies are so many and they're stated with such aplomb as if these people really know, and they don't, or they know and they're not telling the truth. So you've got to get really, really solid on the facts, that you know them well enough that you can respond on the spur of the moment. Not say, just a minute, let me run home and read my notes on that. So educate yourself. And the next step in that would be to come to this conference that was just advertised.
Now, is there a growing acceptance of the 9/11 truth movement within the American public today?
The last poll we had was last summer. And we had a couple big polls, very reputable polls, and one of them suggested that 37% of the American people believe that 9/11 was either orchestrated or deliberately permitted by the Bush administration as a pretext for war in the Middle East. So this is amazing when 99.9% of all mainstream coverage simply repeats the official story, and if they deal with us, they ridicule us. So another poll asked, do you believe you have been told the real truth about 9/11 by the government and the 9/11 Commission? 42% of the people said no. 10% said they didn't know and probably didn't care. And only 48% of the people said yes. So less than 50% of the people are confident that the official story is true. So that's an amazing success story of the movement. Well, now that we've got all of these new organizations, veterans, pilots, engineers, architects, because that's what they were saying all along, you don't have any experts, you're just a bunch of humanities peoples and idiots on the internet. But now we've got all of these very reputable people. One website to go to just to see who's in the movement now and questioning the official story is called Patriots Question 9/11. Now, it's mixed because he's got some people who just question some aspect of it but don't really suggest it was an inside job. But you'll see a large number of the people on there, military people and intelligence people and so on, do say it's an inside job. So it's a growing list of very impressive people.
All right, this next question's a little off topic, but a short answer would be okay. What church do you belong to? I would like to join you.
And what?
And I would like to join you.
Well, I can give two answers to that. My denomination, if that's what it is, I'm a Protestant, and I belong to what's called Christian Churches, parentheses, Disciples of Christ, the main line, or what's now called Old Line Protestant denomination. But if the question is, what is my theological orientation? There is a school of thought known as process theology, based on the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead, Bertrand Russell's math teacher, if you haven't heard of him, who taught at Harvard in the 20s and 30s. And so there's a movement known as process philosophy and then a theological movement using his thought known as process theology. I and my former colleague, John Cobb, wrote a little book that still most people think is the best introduction, even though it's a little stiff going, just called Process Theology and Introductory Exposition. And people say, do you think your theological orientation has made a difference to your work in 9/11? And yes, I think it did. And does. So we have a center called Center for Process Studies. You can check that on Google, and if you want to learn about it, you can do that.
And what about that video of Bin Laden that shows him bragging about the attacks?
This is a video that is very much in debate, and many people think it's a fake. And America's leading Bin Laden expert thinks it's a fake. Other people think it's genuine. I would suggest you look at it for yourself and see what you think.
Are you worried about your own physical safety? Why don't they just silence you?
That's something I don't spend any time thinking about, and for a good reason. There are just two options. Either they leave me alone or they take me out. If they leave me alone, I get to enjoy my old age and my grandkids and finally write my systematic theology. If they take me out, all of my 9/11 books go to number one on the bestseller list. So it's a win-win situation.
And what happens when this 9/11 truth is ultimately accepted? From a theological point of view, what would the ideal outcome be?
What would the ideal
outcome be?
Well, I think I already answered that the issue that we're dealing with is imperialism, and imperialism is a theological issue, and I suggest for Christians nowadays especially, it should be the number one issue that if you're a Christian, your church should be dealing with. If I'm right, if Horsley's right, that it was the number one issue for Jesus, shouldn't it be the number one issue for other Christians? And certainly, if you're a Muslim, it's the number one issue. I mean, the greatest sin, from one perspective, of the 9/11 false flag attack, is although in democratic countries we have this tradition, you are innocent until proven guilty, now Muslims are guilty until they're proven innocent. If this had been a highly Muslim population, I would have got a roaring applause on that line.
Is genuine?
I mean, we really cannot imagine what this is like. Can you imagine that if you get on a plane and you stop to pray before you get on the plane, other passengers are going to ask that you be not allowed to get on the plane? Can you imagine everybody look at you and thinking, is he a terrorist? Is she a terrorist? Is she carrying a bomb? It's unbelievable what we've done to the Muslims of the world. This should be an equally important theological, ethical issue that Christians need to really face. This is atrocious. That's more like it. Thank you.
I think we have two more questions. Is genuine democracy possible in a culture of mass denial? And is 9/11 a result of an assumptive and apathetic culture?
Well, this is really gets to the heart of it. Is democracy possible in our culture now? And why do we have mass denial? Because we have a media that wants to promote mass ignorance. And they do it very effectively. These are very skillful people. They do it in many, many ways. One way is not letting people like me on mainstream television. So you don't give people like me credibility. You don't give people like me a chance to prove we're not raving idiots. That's one of hundreds of ways they have to do it. American press wasn't even going to reveal the 9/11, the Downing Street memo, which had appeared on the front page of the Sunday Times in London, until the bloggers forced them to do it. Finally, people kept writing to the New York Times and the Washington Post and saying, "We're reading all about this. Why aren't you reporting this? This should be the biggest story of the year." We deliberately fabricated the intelligence about weapons of mass destruction, and you're not reporting it. So it's very difficult, and obviously keeping the secret about 9/11 is even more important than keeping that secret. So the remedy, of course, is to quit believing people when they say the Internet is kind of like a garbage dump, an occasional pearl in a vast ocean of garbage. It is not. There is some garbage on there, of course, but there is far more truth than you will find in your mainstream newspapers and on your mainstream television. Another possibility would be for the liberal churches of Canada and the United States to get together and let's form our own media network so we can really inform the people of our countries what they need to know about what's going on in the world. So I hope there's somebody here that is in position to take that idea seriously.
All right, and the last question, which has somewhat been answered, but how do we in Canada go forth to inform the people of the truth of 9/11? What can Canada do?
Oh, that's a great question to end on, because here I can get downright evangelical. I have become convinced if the truth is going to be revealed, it will come about either through Europe or Canada. And here's why. What we need, it's not going to happen in the United States, but if you Canadians, or just you in British Columbia, would get a number of very highly respected citizens, you know, some of the most respected people in your country or your province, form a citizens' jury, then invite members of the 9/11 Truth Movement. And as I revealed in my lecture, you got a lot of them right here in Canada who've done some of the major work. So invite people from Canada, from United States, from the movement to present our evidence to this commission of people who've not made up their mind before. And then invite members of the 9/11 Commission from NIST and the government. Invite Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, to refute what we have said and then render a judgment to the world. I have no doubt about what the answer will be. 9/11 was most assuredly an inside job. And I think if you had some highly respected citizens on this, and it was a very serious deliberative effort, it would be very hard for the press not to report it. And the American press would try mightily, but they probably would even have to report it. So that's my answer to the question. So whoever raised that question, thank you very much. It was a great question to end on. And thank you all very much for coming.
Dr. David Ray Griffin, speaking May 16th in Vancouver, BC. For more information on the Vancouver Conference on 9/11, Canada and the New World Order, visit v911.org, v911.org. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
My end, for my guns and my saddle will all